If you love St. Patrick's Day but you hate green, Nike has the shoe for you, or so it thought.
The athletic apparel behemoth is releasing a new version of its SB Dunk Low, a popular casual shoe. It is black and tan colored, and since we're getting close to St. Paddy's Day, the shoe has a nickname that is apparently beer-inspired. The black and tan.
And that's where Nike gets into trouble. Here in the U.S. or in Britain, you might order a black and tan at a pub and get a mixture of an Irish stout, such as Guinness, and a lager, like Harp. But that's not the original meaning of black and tan.
I talked today with Brian Boyd of the Irish Times newspaper, and he explained.
It has certain historical associations. The black and tans were a ruthless auxiliary force of the British Army before we became independent in the 1920s. They were responsible for wide-scale massacres, butchering of people. We don't even, for example, in the US, you may go into a bar and ask for a drink, call it black and tan.
And that would be, I'm not saying this from great personal familiarity, that would be a half of a black beer, like a Guinness, and a half of a pale ale with it. But you wouldn't call it that in Ireland.
No, we'd use different terms. And in fact, we wouldn't really dilute our Guinness over here. It's not really the done thing to do.
Now, Nike has released a statement saying, "We apologize. No offense was intended." At the same time, Nike says the sneaker has been, quote, unofficially named by some as the black and tan.
That said, if you look inside the shoe, as we have done with online photos, you see an image of a pint of beer with two colors, black and tan.
Brian Boyd of the Irish Times has reported on some outrage over the shoe, but really, he says, it's not about a shoe. It's about a holiday.
It's how the Americans view St. Patrick's Day and view Irish culture and history. And it's the very fact that some people are saying that these are beer-themed sneakers, that the only way to celebrate a national holiday of a country with a very rich culture and a very rich history in literature, etc., is to pour massive amounts of alcohol down your body. It's how the Americans treat St. Patrick's Day. Mm-hmm. So we're using this story to say, look, it's the silly Americans, stupid Americans, look what they're doing again. They've got it all wrong.
Which is, by the way, a default mode for journalism across the pond.
But still, it seems Nike did not have its smartest moment with the black and tan shoe.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Learn more about the music and artists you hear on NPR and discover new music by visiting npr.org/music. There you can also hear a Tiny Desk concert or get an exclusive first listen of new music. This is NPR.
There is usually no shortage of creativity at the South by Southwest Interactive Festival in Austin, but this year one innovation has been controversial: homeless hotspots, a project where homeless people are given wireless cards and people can approach them to exchange donations for access to the internet. Critics of the project say it's exploiting the homeless, but Megan Garber of The Atlantic thinks otherwise. We'll get her take in a second, but first, we'd like to hear from you. Is this project an opportunity for the homeless or exploitation? Call us at 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, or you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Megan Garber's a staff writer for The Atlantic magazine. Her piece titled Wi-Fi Hotspots Made of Homeless People, Not as Horrible as They Seem. It ran on the Atlantic website on March 12th, and she joins us now from studios at the Atlantic here in Washington. Megan, welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thanks. Glad to be here.
So first, you write, it is perfectly okay to be offended at first glance by this project. You call it digital colonialism. So let me ask you, what was your first reaction?
My first reaction was that this was horrible and exploitative, a little bit dystopian, actually. But really, the more I thought about it, the more I just thought, you know, it's a business opportunity like any other for homeless people that don't get very many business opportunities. And I think if any other type of person were, you know, afforded this opportunity, we wouldn't have any problem with it at all. It seems that homelessness itself is the main issue here. And I don't think it should be.
So tell us, how does it work? Who is the company that's sponsoring this, and how does it actually work?
The company is called BBH, which stands for Bartle, Bogle, and Hegarty. They're the marketing firm that also did the Axe body spray commercials, if you remember those. And basically, I mean, one of their main points was just to get the word out about homelessness and the problems that it has. And
so it's a marketing ploy, which we could say should be judged very successful so far.
Exactly.
We're sitting here talking
they definitely
about it.
Got the word out. That is very true.
Okay.
And they've
duly noted.
Run programs before. Yes, definitely. They've run a program before in New York City called Unheard New York, where they were trying to empower people to tell their story by giving them phones that they could use to have Twitter accounts and tell their stories via social media. So this isn't the first time that they've experimented, actually, with charitable initiatives.
But so how does it work, though? There's, as I understand it, 15 homeless people taking part, and what happens?
That's right. So the 15 homeless people were given basically mobile devices where they would have the devices and they basically converted themselves into mobile hotspots, the same kind that you would have at Starbucks or something like that. And then people who are attending the conference can get sort of immediate Wi-Fi access through those devices.
Because this is all these high-tech techies down there who can't stand to be off network even when they're crossing the street. Is that the idea?
Exactly. And one of the common complaints about the conference, very ironically, is that because there are so many people there using so many devices, the web access is actually not very good. So this was actually trying to solve, believe it or not, a market problem at the conference.
So there's not a set fee. People just give what they want for this access?
Exactly. It's you can give what you want. They suggest about $2 or so, but it can completely vary. The volunteers also get paid a set fee of $20 just for their work. So it's basically, you know, doing work at the conference just like, you know, you would do if you were helping set up, you know, the stands or the tables or anything like that.
And do we have any sense what they're making?
No, they have not released the numbers yet. All that they have told me in my reporting is that the people who tend to be a little bit more gregarious and who really engage conference goers in conversation and talk and really make a point of telling their story, they make a lot more money. But they have not released the exact numbers.
Okay. And they've actually put some of their stories online. Can you tell us a little bit about the people that are taking part in this?
Sure. So the main theme seems to be that, you know, people just really want their stories to be told. They want to sort of take away a little bit of the curiosity, I guess, about homelessness. And they want to sort of make the point that this is not a choice. This is something that happened to me. There's one man, Clarence, who is a victim of Hurricane Katrina. There are other people who there was one person who was a victim of traumatic brain injury. And so he's had trouble finding jobs and just a lot of different stories that I think make the condition of homelessness a lot more relatable.
All right, let's take a call from a listener. Jonathan is in Hammond, Indiana. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, go right ahead.
All right, so I was saying that I think that the company is exploiting the image or the stigma around homelessness negatively, and I think that if this, you know, if the company was willing to do this around, you know, a bookstore or a coffee shop, that this really wouldn't be a question that NPR would host kind of thing, because it'd just be like, yeah, you know, like we would take it in stride as a society. But I think that this company is exploiting the image of homelessness. And while there might be some people around that have fallen on hard economic times, veterans, people that have had medical issues, that on the flip side, there's also those people that just, I don't want to say are taking their chunk, but you know, are buying illicit drugs and alcohol, and so there's that fine line between, you know, how do we support the homeless versus, you know, the company image that they're projecting by doing this.
So if you were down there, Jonathan, say you were at the conference and crossing the street and wanted to check your email or something, would you take part in this program and buy access or no?
I personally would not. I think that I have done my fair share of supporting, you know, shelters and places where the homeless can go, in a positive manner to you know, get their feedback under them. And so I would not participate in this.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
All right. Thank you very much.
So, Megan, I guess it's a common reaction there.
I think it is, and I think it's a great point because it really is a fine line. I mean, you know, empowering and exploitation, there can be a really small space between the two. And I'm I think all of that is right. I think there are also problems with the optics of it. You know, the whole program is called Homeless Hotspot. So the implication is not that homeless people are using the idea of hotspot to empower themselves. It really conveys this idea of the homeless person being used as a hotspot. And I think, you know, there are problematic things with that. So, you know, I'm not 100% in favor of the way that the program has been marketed. But I think that ultimately, you know, the people are making a choice to participate in the program. They're hoping to use it to tell their story. So I think, you know, in the whole, it's for a good cause, and I think it's a good thing. But it's a very good point. This is not 100% without problems.
And you've written that it kind of juxtaposes poverty and privilege. I mean, the idea of someone sitting there checking their high-powered friend's email next to, I guess it can make for some uncomfortable situations or maybe some engaging situations.
Exactly. And I think the point that it can do both is actually a good thing because, frankly, this is something that we should be talking about. And there are homeless people in Austin just like there are homeless people in most cities. And I think, you know, the tendency is just to ignore it, to say, well, that's not my problem. It's, you know, not part of this conference. And I appreciate that BBH is trying to sort of juxtapose, you know, the real world reality with the digital potential that's being explored at the conference.
All right. We have an email from Katie in Berlin, New Hampshire, who says, just got back from South by Southwest, thought the Wi-Fi homeless idea was great. She says there are two things always in short supply at South by Southwest, taxis and Wi-Fi. If we can help the homeless and solve a problem at the same time, I think it's great. A lot better than making them drive pedicabs. Okay, let's take a phone call here. Troy in Richmond, Virginia. Hi there.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I wanted to chime in on the homeless the hotspot issue.
We'd love to hear your opinion.
I think it's both. I think it definitely is exploitation, but I don't necessarily believe that exploitation in this manner is a bad thing if it's regulated. So it may give the homeless person a chance to network. Just because they're homeless doesn't mean they don't have skills and don't have an ability to get back into the workforce. So I think that's good. On the other hand, I think that they need to be fairly compensated. It's like it should go in with like a union right from the beginning of some sort, is my opinion.
Okay, that's an interesting idea. All right, thank you so much. Let's take another quick call here. Robert in New Haven, Connecticut. Go right ahead.
Yes, hi. I completely agree with your guest. I think she's really said all the right things. I would just contribute one thing that I've been in two places where there have been bottle bills introduced, and one of the arguments against a bottle bill.
And you might tell us what that is?
Collecting cans and bottles, putting a deposit on cans and bottles. One of the arguments against them has been that it would be degrading to homeless people to be going around with shopping carts collecting all of these cans and bottles. Well, you know, that's looking out for other people's... I don't think that's necessarily such a altruistic view, and in fact, it's an argument that the bottlers particularly like to make. It benefits everybody, and there aren't a lot of opportunities for this population to get a job and to connect with other people. I think it's very good on many levels. I'm in favor of it.
All right. Well, thanks for calling. Megan Garber, the organizers have said that they kind of see this as modernizing the little businesses you see of homeless people selling newspapers that they have produced on the streets. That kind of newspapers are old-fashioned. People don't actually read them anymore, but this is something people could really use, and it's kind of a business concept.
Exactly. And I think they really focused on allowing the people themselves to tell their stories. So that's why, you know, there's conversation involved. You don't just enter a code to get the Wi-Fi access. You actually talk to the people. And they're trying to frame it very entrepreneurially. They're not, you know, like I mentioned, there is the sort of human hotspot framing. But the way that they also talk about it is that the homeless people are actually managers of these technological devices. And, you know, they're selling a product. And part of what they're doing to sell that product is telling their stories. So they're really trying to bring that newspaper idea of, you know, the narrative, the empowering narrative to the technological world.
And do you have any idea if there are plans to expand this experiment?
Well, it will depend on the success of the experiment. And I think part of the success will be determined by how much money the people actually make. But I really do applaud the idea of, you know, trying to use new technologies to find new ways to help people. And I think as much as we can talk about this being exploitative, I mean, bottom line, these people are volunteering for the program. They're excitedly volunteering. They actually applied for it and, you know, went through a fairly rigorous process to be part of it. So I think ultimately that says everything, that they want to be involved.
And 15 was the limit, but more people wanted to take part.
Right.
Did you speak with the homeless shelter that is also taking part in this, that is sponsoring those?
I did not. I spoke to the head of innovation at BBH, who was running it. I'm unfortunately not in Austin, so I was hoping I could actually talk to some of the people who are on the street there and get that perspective, but I've had to rely on other reporters to do that.
All right, but you've got lots of Wi-Fi here in D.C., so.
Exactly.
All right.
Not as much of a problem for me.
Megan Garber is a staff writer for The Atlantic, and she joined us from studios at the magazine here in Washington. You can find a link to her piece at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And Megan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Getting pulled by the ear for misbehaving in class or lying across a teacher's legs for a spanking may seem like a relic of the past, but 19 states still allow public schools to paddle students who behave badly. According to the Center for Effective Discipline, most incidents take place in rural parts of the mountain and southern states, where such punishment is something of a tradition. Well, now in Florida, a mother plans to sue a school district because her 5-year-old son was paddled without her permission. WLRN Miami Herald reporter Sarah Gonzalez went to small-town Florida to find out why schools want the right to spank students.
There are some parts of Florida where getting spanked at school on your butt with a wooden or fiberglass board isn't a big deal.
You put your hands on the desk and look forward.
You just get hit 2 or 3 times and then it's over with.
I've been getting them since about first grade, just regular.
That's Cole Long, Claire Ginn, and Lucas Mixon, middle and high school students in North Florida, where almost every county has laws on the books allowing the paddling of students. Public schools are the only public institution where hitting is allowed, not in prisons, hospitals, mental institutions, or the military. The most recent data shows about 3,600 students were spanked in Florida in 2010. Efforts to ban school corporal punishment statewide failed this year. And that's just fine for parents like Bud Glover of Bonifay, Florida.
I got my butt beat. I know what's right and wrong, and my children are going to know what's right and wrong.
Bonifay is a small town in the Florida Panhandle, 15 miles from the Alabama border, where tradition is valued. And Eddie Dixon, principal at Holmes County High School, is a traditionalist when it comes to spanking misbehaving students.
Well, it's just, you know, that kind of thing. And that didn't really hurt, it's just the sound.
It's a wooden board, and it sure looks like it hurts. Picture a really short rowboat paddle, a rectangle with a handle about 16 inches long, 5 inches wide, and 1/2 inch thick. Students at the high school get paddled about twice a week for doing things like,
oh, doing stupid stuff, you know, throwing papers, throwing pencils, a couple times for cussing and then back talking. I used to be a really wild child.
That's Cole Long, a senior at Holmes County High. He says the spankings teach students discipline and respect. But every once in a while, a parent from one of these small towns will say, that's my job, like Tanika Jones of Levy County. Last year, the principal at Joyce Bullock Elementary sent home a waiver asking parents for permission to paddle students. Jones didn't sign it, but her son, Jirye Bostic, was paddled on his second week of preschool anyway. Jirye says the principal spanked him twice for slapping another boy on the school bus.
He said, take my jacket off. Then when I take my jacket off, then spank me with my booty. Then it was hard, then I cried, then I said sorry, then we went on the bus, then I cried all the way home. It was really hard.
The paddling left welts on Jirye's bottom, and his mom was outraged.
If I would have hit my son how she hit him, I would have been in jail. I would have been on the news. I would have been messed up trying to get my children back how she hit my son. She whipped him up, and to me, that's child abuse.
Jirye's mom is in the process of suing the Levy County School District for paddling her son without her permission. But state law does not require schools to get parental consent. The school's principal and the school district would not comment because they're in pre-litigation. But the principal has said that permission slips are only a courtesy. Many studies on school corporal punishment show paddling does not deter kids from misbehaving. Students who are paddled once are often re-paddled. But supporters argue that paddling punishes students and keeps them in school, because the alternative for students with bad behavior would be suspension. Willie Williams agrees. He's principal at Madison County Central Elementary and Middle School. The only problem is he can't bring himself to administer the punishment. And when others do it?
I have to walk out. I'm a softy really at heart. I actually have to walk out because I just...
As principal, Williams could ban the practice.
If I believed in that, but I am a part of the community.
And he says this community supports school corporal punishment. And in rural Florida, that's not likely to change anytime soon. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Gonzalez in Miami.
That story is part of the State Impact Project. State Impact is a collaboration between NPR and member stations examining the effect of state policy on people's lives.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Allison Keyes. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we look at how con artists use mail to scam the elderly. I'll talk with a member of the U.S. Postal Inspection Service about some common swindles and how to catch them. That's just ahead. But first, we look at another way consumers are being tricked into losing thousands of dollars. Payday loan companies promise fast cash before your next paycheck. Maybe you've heard the ads on the radio, or you've seen the late-night commercials featuring pitchmen like Montel Williams.
Are you facing an unexpected car repair bill, a medical emergency, or just need cash until payday? Well, you may not have that money today, but you can in about 24 hours.
A quick cash advance might seem like a good idea, but as Washington Post columnist Petula Dvorak writes, it really isn't, always. Borrowing money from short-term loan companies can lead to interest rates to the triple digits and mountains of debt. She joins us right here in the studio. Petula, welcome back to Tell Me More.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you recently wrote about a maintenance man here in D.C. named Tyrone Newman, and he wanted to give his family a nice Christmas. So he dipped into the mortgage money for things like a Christmas tree and a nice turkey, but he didn't want to tell his wife. So after hearing an ad on the radio, he decided to take out a $500 loan. What happened next?
Well, poor Tyrone, he really did. He deserved a good Christmas. He had a year of being laid off and after that a good solid year of work. So you should hear him tell the story. He was so excited. He got everyone presents, his wife, I think even his mother-in-law he got presents for. And what happened? He rolled up his debt in mortgage, $1,300. So he got three $500 loans to make that $1,500. Thought it was okay, he'd covered in the next payday. Turns out they charge a $175 service fee for each of those loans.
Wait, $175 for each of the three loans?
Yes, for each of them. And to make matters worse, when he paid that, when he tried to make his first payment on his loan, he just paid down that service fee for each of those loans. And it rolled up, and soon he was owing a lot more than he could ever make in a single paycheck.
How much more is a lot more?
Well, if we did the math on the back of a napkin, Tyrone and I, when we had lunch, I paid. And if he had gone on his current path, that $1,500 would have cost him $18,000 in a year. He was paying 651% interest on those loans.
651%.
Not kidding.
Interest. How does everything add up so quickly?
It's so fast. Tyrone showed me one of the emails from the company. He couldn't understand why, when he tried to pay down his $500 that he owed to one company, they immediately gave him that $175 service fee, which when you first get that loan seems like a one-time fee. But then he got this email. He says, "Your loan has been renewed twice because we did not hear from you at least 2 to 3 business days before your due date."
Before your due date.
Before your due date. I don't pay anything, I mean, before my due date. That's good business, right? I mean,
right.
Your due date is your due date. But they decided, the way they work, they renewed his loan, basically refinanced it completely for him, and charged him a new $175 fee before he even knew it. And they sucked all this right out of his bank account.
And this is not just the payday loan companies you find next to your neighborhood liquor store. This is banks like Wells Fargo that are doing this now, right?
That's what's really scary, and that's what has some of these consumer watchdog groups up in arms again. What Tyrone used was online and over the phone companies. One was a tribal company based in Michigan. Another was in Delaware, and they have their laws are such that they can operate under their sovereign tribal laws and federal laws, and they're not subject to the state laws. Here in D.C., we got rid of payday loans. Those, you know those places. You see them between a liquor store and the Chinese sub takeout. In 2007, we got rid of them in D.C., and about 30 states have. They've capped those, but banks are getting into it now.
Let me just jump in and say, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about payday loans and how borrowing a few hundred dollars can lead to thousands in repayments. Petula Dvorak is a columnist with The Washington Post. So this practice is legal.
It is legal.
In 30 states.
30 states have capped it.
30 states have stopped
They've
it.
They've capped
okay.
double-digit interest rates. Now, there's there are places that still charge. There was one that the Center for Public Integrity did an amazing piece on that charged 911% interest.
But let me ask you, what about the people that don't have credit cards or access to other lines of credit? I mean, this is a legitimate service that they need, right?
It is, and it certainly can work for some folks. Most of the terms are 10 to 14 days. If you need that cash and you really can make it up in your paycheck right away, then it works. But for most people, it doesn't. The ones that the banks are getting into now, Wells Fargo, Guarantee, Regions, they're starting at 400% interest. Their record isn't very good. Their terms are 10 days. If you pay it back in 10 days, you're cool. You just paid your service fee. But the reality is that it takes an average of 175 days to pay that back.
But let me ask, there are those that might say that the interest rates sound high, but if you've agreed to do this, you've read the contract, I mean, shouldn't people be responsible for these kind of payments if that's what they said they do?
Sure. There's a whole theory of personal responsibility. But for the grace of God go I. We all slip up. And as you can see in this letter from this loan company that Tyrone communicated with, slipping up means not calling them 2 to 3 days before. I don't know. That's like getting grounded for coming home, you know, at 9:45 when your curfew is 10. That's wrong. And that's what's got a lot of these consumer groups angry.
I do want to say that we invited Tyrone to join us, but he wasn't able to make it work with his busy schedule. But how did his story end up? Is he okay?
He's okay. He's really lucky. His boss paid for it. His boss gave him a loan, saw what was, and he contacted me. His boss is a reader of the column, and I've seen him around town, and he said, "This is insane. I can't believe this is happening." And fortunately, Tyrone agreed to tell his story to me because he thinks that a lot of folks have asked him about it, and a lot of folks can think that this is a quick way to help out your finances.
And briefly, words of wisdom for anybody that might find themselves in their car thinking, I'm going to call that 800 number right now.
Well, the way I got to quote Tyrone because it was perfect, because he didn't tell his wife about this, and he said, anything you don't want to tell your little wife about is probably a bad idea.
That is my favorite quote from the entire article. Petula Dvorak is a columnist with The Washington Post. She wrote about payday loans in her latest column. She joined us right here in the studio. Petula, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
When you think of blockbuster bestsellers, what comes to mind generally are mysteries, crime novels, romances, not so much ethical or moral fiction. That's what Jodi Picou calls her novels. With 33 million copies of her books now in circulation, NPR's Lynn Neary wondered how Picou could be so popular by writing about divisive issues.
While promoting her new book at the Free Library in Philadelphia, Jodi Picou made some members of her audience howl, literally. Picou used this lesson in howling to show how much she learned about wolves while researching her latest book, Lone Wolf. It was also a vivid demonstration of Pico's special talent for connecting with her fans. Her longtime editor, Emily Bessler, says that special bond with the reader was there from the beginning. Bessler remembers that right before she began working with Pico, she saw two young women on the subway reading her books.
And I said, oh, you know, how are those? Are those good books? And they both went on for 5 minutes, complete strangers, about how they worshiped Jodi Pico, how they waited breathlessly for every trade paperback. And I thought, wow, that's impressive. That's not what you hear every day.
At the event in Philadelphia, a long line of fans snaked through the echoing hallways of the Free Library, eager to get a moment with Pico. It was the end of a long day, but Pico was unfailingly cheerful as she signed copies of her books.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you.
What makes Pico's popularity somewhat surprising is the subject she chooses to write about. In her novels, Pico has taken on a long list of issues that a lot of people avoid thinking about.
Neonaticide, the death penalty, mercy killing, stem cell research, what it means to believe in God or not believe in God, the right to die, gay rights.
Just to name a few, Pico takes a controversial issue and lets her characters hash out their differences over it, usually in the context of a family facing some kind of crisis. Pico says she tends to write about subjects that keep her awake at night.
Really, I think I have sort of gravitated towards issues that I don't know the answers to, because that's what's more interesting for me to write. The act of writing it is the act of trying to understand why my opinion is what it is. And ultimately, I think that's the same experience the reader has when they pick up one of my books.
In Lone Wolf, a brother and sister must decide whether to terminate medical care for their father, who's in a vegetative state after a car accident. The sister, Kara, was also in the accident and is determined to keep her father alive. The brother, Edward, who has been estranged from his family, wants to let their father go and donate his organs to someone who needs them. In this scene, the brother thinks the two have resolved their differences.
My sister is glassy-eyed, slack-jawed, almost asleep, but she fixes her gaze directly on mine. I can't do this, Kara murmurs. I just want it to be over. It feels like a plea. It feels as if, for the first time in 6 years, I might be in a position to help her. I look down at my sister. I'll take care of it, I promise, knowing how much these words have cost her. I'll take care of everything.
At the center of this story is the father, Luke, a researcher whose life was so taken over by the wolves he studied that at one point he left his family to live with a wolf pack. Pico says she wanted Luke to be a larger-than-life character.
Because I think that's probably the most devastating thing, when someone who is larger-than-life winds up a shadow of themselves in a hospital bed. And one day I woke up thinking about wolves. No idea why. I have no affinity for wolves. I know nothing about wolves, you know, beyond what most people tend to know. And I started to do a little research, and I began to think, what if I created a guy who had lived with a wild pack, who didn't just study them from afar, but actually lived with them?
Pico is not the kind of writer who just makes things up. She does extensive research for her books, delving into medical, scientific, and ethical research, visiting hospitals, even prisons if necessary. In the case of Lone Wolf, she learned everything she could about wolves and spent time with a researcher who actually had lived with a pack. But for all her interest in research and facts, Pico still believes she can have the greatest impact on her readers through fiction.
If you read a book that's fiction and you get caught in the characters and the plot and swept away really by the just the fiction of it, by the non-reality, you sometimes wind up changing your reality as well. And often when the last page is turned, it will haunt you. It's a much gentler approach sometimes into a controversial subject than nonfiction is.
Waiting for Pico to sign their books the other night, Rachel Minnick, Susan Brokelbach, and Carrie Dunn said they've been reading Pico's books for years.
Thank you, Jodi.
Sure.
We feel very blessed because we've seen you twice now. So.
Where did you see me last time?
In Reading.
The three friends said they love the way Pico combines fact with fiction.
I love the fact that she tackles some really tough topics, and she... her character development is amazing, and you just fall in love with her characters and her stories. She's an incredible storyteller.
Yeah. And what is it you like so much about her book?
I just like the different ideas that she comes up with, the different stories. They're just so interesting, and like Rachel said, they really make you think about things that you haven't normally thought about.
I think primarily I like the fact that there's so much research that goes into her books. I really do. I think that it's not just that she's a good storyteller, there's research behind it, so you learn something every time you read one of her books.
Pico doesn't take her fans for granted. She gets around 200 emails a day and answers them all. But she doesn't think it's just personal attention which brings readers back to her books year after year.
I think the reason that these readers come back to me is because I represent their points of view. It may not be my point of view, but that's okay. You know, everyone still deserves to have their say, and I always look at it sort of like the facets of a diamond. You've got to illuminate each one and then let the reader decide what's the brightest one and why. You know, my job isn't to tell them which is the brightest one. It's just to illuminate every single facet.
Pico, who also happens to be a mother of three, generally writes a book a year. She finished the first draft of her next book before heading out on this book tour and already has started researching another one. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Want to mention you can follow NPR News and many NPR correspondents on Facebook, on Google Plus, and on Twitter. This program is at Morning Edition and at NPR Inskeep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
As the economy has come back, manufacturing companies have been doing much of the hiring. Some of those jobs are in factories that have picked up work which used to be done overseas. It's pretty hard to say exactly how many jobs this amounts to. Still, it is a happy development for some workers. NPR's Annie Baxter went to Minnesota to look into the trend that some call insourcing and others call reshoring.
Like a lot of manufacturers, Hiawatha Rubber Company hit a rut in the recession. The factory is based outside Minneapolis and makes rubber components that go into things like printers and pumps. When business dropped off about 40% in the downturn, production hours were slashed. Workers like Richard Bolio had to make do working just 3 or 4 days a week. That went on for nearly a year.
That was a long time. Many, many months. Many, many months and a lot of soup. Let me tell you, a lot of soup. But you just, you know, buck it up and get through it.
Bolio and the other 65 full-timers are back to normal hours now and can even pull some overtime. That's thanks in part to the uptick in the economy. It's driving demand for products like the one Bolio is making on this day. He's operating a molding machine that makes rubber parts for a radiator. The machine looks like a giant waffle iron. After the molding process is completed, Bolio secures a plate over the parts.
And when you lift it up, that's how you get all your parts off the bottom of the mold. Interesting, huh?
But it's not just economic improvements that are keeping workers like Bolio in good spirits and machines like this humming lately. On top of that, work that had been sent overseas is now coming back and landing at Hiawatha Rubber. Howard Hauser, a vice president here, says for a long time, manufacturers followed a herd mentality in sending work offshore. They all wanted components produced in emerging markets like China.
They were looking at the piece price. The piece price, you know, looked like, okay, we're going to save a lot of money, you know, but the bottom line was they didn't save nearly as much as they thought. And with the quality issues, they're just getting product that's, you know, not acceptable for the customers.
Now Hiawatha's getting those contracts. And Hauser has himself decided to reshore production of a component that was getting made in China. It will result in 3 new hires at his plant. He says the part was not hard to make, but Hiawatha can do it better. The Chinese factory just kept botching the job.
They don't have the transportation systems. They don't have the educational systems. They don't have the infrastructure that we do.
Dan Mextroth is an economist with the Manufacturers Alliance for Productivity and Innovation. He says labor in the U.S. is looking more competitive internationally lately for a lot of reasons. Labor costs in the States are still depressed due to the weak recovery, whereas those costs are rising in emerging markets. The skill level of American workers is higher, and supply chain disruptions after the Japanese disasters made some companies skittish about outsourcing to Asia. But Mextroth says it's really hard to quantify any job gains from reshoring. The U.S. has added about 400,000 manufacturing jobs over the past couple years. It's unlikely that lots of them are tied to work returning.
It's a trickle, but a trickle back is better than the tidal wave out.
However many jobs you might add, Mextroth says manufacturing is never going to make up the ground it lost in the recession. which was on the order of 2 million jobs. Surprisingly, that's not a fact Howard Hauser at Hiawatha Rubber Company laments.
You hear all the politicians, you know, talking about, you know, we want to bring back jobs. It's not about bringing back the old kind of jobs. We need to be creating new jobs, the technology jobs.
At his factory, Hauser's looking to automate a bigger share of production with robotics. That's especially true for a new business line they're launching for wastewater treatment systems. The work will require tech-savvy employees who can program robots to take over the manual labor.
You should be chasing no labor, which is, you know, what we're doing.
So even as work is coming back from offshore and increasing the headcount at his factory now, Hauser expects automation will shrink his workforce down the road. That might sound harsh, but he says the workers who stay on will be high-skilled and high-paid. Annie Baxter, NPR News, St. Paul.
And you can find more stories in our series Looking Up, Pockets of Economic Strength, at npr.org.
This is NPR News.